This is the Impact Report. I'm your host, Katie Ullman. The Impact Report brings together students and faculty in Bard College's MBA in Sustainability program with leaders in business, sustainability, finance, social entrepreneurship, and more. These conversations go live the first and third Friday of each month. This week, Bard MBA's Caitlin O'Donnell speaks with Keely Tillotson, CEO of Wild Friends Foods.
Keely, I'm so excited to be meeting you via audio. I have been following your company for about a year and a half now. I found you guys through some of the influencers that I follow on social media, and was really drawn to your company because of the message you guys convey to your audience. And being in a sustainable MBA program, I wanted to get a sense of your entrepreneurial journey. I'm very interested in addressing the age gap that exists within the entrepreneurial space and also the gender gap. And so every time I see women doing really interesting things and having their companies scale, I just am so inspired and so really excited to get a sense of your journey today and learn more about what you're doing with Wild Friends.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me here. I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
Can you just tell us a bit of some general background about Wild Friends Foods? What are your products? Where are you based?
Yeah, so we are an all-natural food company based in Portland, Oregon, and we started in college. My co-founder Erica and I started Wild Friends in college as sophomores, and we were college athletes. So Erica rode crew, and I was on the triathlon team, and we were both vegetarians, so we ate a lot of peanut butter, as you might imagine, like many college students. And one day we ran out of our classic crunchy natural nut butter. And Erica had just received a food processor for Christmas, and this was in the spring of 2011. And so we decided to try making our own with a food processor and a bunch of ingredients we had on hand, because it was too rainy to bike to the store to buy more. So we started making all these different flavors, because once something's in a food processor, all you want to do is add other ingredients to it. So we made a chocolate flavor and one with honey and pretzel pieces and one with coffee and all these different peanut butters. And brought them over to our friend's house later that night, and they were very well received. So we started selling them at local farmers markets, totally for fun. And this is just such a side project. Neither of us are business majors. She was environmental studies in Spanish, and I was majoring in journalism. And so we just started doing this for fun. And it's been 7 years since then, and the company's grown a lot. We've just always done whatever the next step might be. So we ended up launching in local stores and then growing our store presence. Now we sell nationwide. And the mission of the company is to make food friendly. So we started with peanut butter, and that's taking a product people love and taking out all the non-essentials. So no hydrogenated oil, no palm oil, no sugar in our plain classic creamy. Then making different flavors, which is really fun, and making sure they're really innovative but still really clean label. And then we've recently expanded into breakfast items. So with our new oats and nut butter, which are a single serve oat cup with a nut butter packet in the lid. And so they deliver twice as much protein and half the sugar as plain. So really exciting times ahead. We're working on more innovation and launching new items. But it's really been a really fun, eventful last 7 years.
Right. Yeah, I actually got hooked on your product because of the oatmeal cups. They just were...
Oh, cool.
Yeah, a great solution for people who are on the go, and I travel a lot for work, and so I pack one in my bag and always feel like I have something healthy to eat for breakfast, which is important. I'm wondering if you can tell us about sort of the decision to keep certain things out of your product, and so... the palm oil ingredient, for instance, my understanding is that it's pretty difficult to leave that key ingredient out of the product. And what were the challenges like? And to leave that out, I noticed that your labels say that, you know, you leave palm oil out and to please knead and massage your peanut butter basically before you use it. So I think you've done a really great job of making that clear to your customers. But what were some of the back end conversations about leaving that out?
Yeah, so it's funny because I think a lot of the decisions we've made weren't necessarily done in that way. Like, what should we do about palm oil? Because if you think about it from a consumer perspective, if you're making peanut butter and you don't have any food science background, the first thing you're going to want, the only thing you think you want in your peanut butter is peanuts and maybe some salt. And so that's what we did right out of the gate. And then it wasn't until after we'd had probably started selling product at farmers markets that we've realized that so many of our competitors were using palm oil. And that's really just to prevent separation. We experimented. We were like, well, it could be great if our product didn't separate. Let's try some, you know, let's do some batches with palm oil. And it was really early on. And we just felt like it limited the flavor so much because really what you're adding is sort of a vegetable oil. And it just really does not, you know, it doesn't lend itself to flavor. So it wasn't a taste plus. And then when you do research on palm oil, it's really a not environmental plus either. It's really bad for the environment. So those two things combined made us think, I don't think we need this. I think our consumer is smart enough to understand that if they stir their jar, they can get a better tasting product that's better for the environment. And so we've, you know, always done our best to really educate the consumer about that. And we've also understand that for some people that want a product that's completely emulsified and not pop, you know, they don't want to stir it, we might not be the nut butter for them right now. And that's okay too.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. You started off doing the right thing without even realizing that this is what your audience may be interested in.
Yeah, exactly. And that happens a lot, you know, a lot, I think, with companies that are really created by consumers and created by consumer need, because so many of these sort of strange things that are in our food are invented by big companies that need to solve big company problems, not consumers solving consumer problems.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Can you tell us about how your team has grown since you and your co-founder started the company?
Yeah, so we have, it's grown and changed quite a bit. I mean, for the first couple of years, we were very scrappy. It was just Erica and myself doing everything. So all the management of manufacturing, all of the marketing, all of the sales, everything. And it was just only over the last 3 years that we started hiring team members. So we brought on our first team member in 2015. So we did it by ourselves for a while. And now there are 11 of us. We have three people on our sales team. We have two marketing team members, three operations team members, and a couple other folks that help us manage all the big and little details of running and growing a business.
Right. And have you experienced sort of a changing in your culture? Has your work changed as the CEO and managing that team?
For sure. I mean, I think a big realization for me, I mean, we started this company in 18 and 19. So everything we know about everything, anything really, we've learned in on the job. And I think one of the biggest things that I've learned is that, you know, culture isn't something you can just write down. Like, this is my company culture, done, dust off your hands. You know, it's, you're always building the company culture. Every person you hire is the culture. So, you know, we've definitely made hiring mistakes where we've hired somebody thinking, you know, this person has the skill set that we need and so they're going to do great, because it's all it takes to succeed in our company is to have the skills, and then we bring the culture, right? So like, we'll bring, one of our values is being a no ego doer. So, you know, you could say to yourself, you know, as long as I'm a no ego doer, that will trickle down and other people will act that way too. But that's actually, it's not the case. Like, anyone you hire, they bring their own culture to the company. So we really now look for people that already demonstrate elements of the culture that we want, because they're going to bring that to the company. And oftentimes the really, really amazing team members that we've brought on, they make the culture better, or they bring their own elements to the company as well. So culture definitely changes a lot. I mean, every person you hire impacts it. So I'd say that common elements of our culture is being like a learner. Because Erica and myself, like, we're learners, like, we want to learn new things. We definitely are not afraid to say we don't know something. And we tend to bond really well with team members who work similarly and, you know, show up and may or may not know something, but we'll work hard to figure it out. But new things that have come into our culture, you know, could be things like independence, for example, like hiring team members that really work well independently and can get a lot done. That's something that's been added to our culture by some of our team members. So it's been fun to watch it evolve for sure.
Right, right. And as you grow, it'll probably change 20 more times.
Definitely.
So, yeah, I'm curious. My understanding is that you and your co-founder, Erica, went through your capital raising process as a team. And so can you tell us a bit about how that went, what some of your strategies were, and if there were any challenges being, you know, two young women under 20 engaging in this sort of work?
Yeah, fundraising is definitely hard work. I mean, we have fundraised 3 times, each time with a little bit of a different angle. But I'd say that the strategy is about the same, which is that it's like dating. You just have to go on so many first dates with so many people to find someone who's a good fit for both sides. And I wish that someone would have explained that to me when I first started fundraising, because you hear these stories of folks going to go fundraise and, you know, kind of have one meeting with a dynamic funder and the person writes the check, you know, right there and in the moment and slides it across the table. And that is not very many people's experiences. I think most of us end up talking to people, someone who knows someone who knows someone, and doing as much networking as possible to have as many conversations as possible, in order to find the maybe 1 to 2 people that will invest in you. Like, I have a spreadsheet of all the different people we talked to, the different funds we talked to for our recent round. And, you know, you talk to 50 people to find the one fund that is not only likes the business and wants to invest, but can write the size check that you want. You like them and you want them involved in your business. So definitely, you know, it takes so much time. It is like a full-time job. And it's really, really easy to get discouraged. So I talk to folks that are saying, you know, I've been fundraising for a couple months and just haven't found the right fit, and am I doing it wrong? And the answer is usually no, you're doing it right. You just have to meet a lot of people. So I think the tactic has been, you know, Erica and I really keep each other, we keep each other's energy up, because it can be challenging. And it's also a little bit frustrating, because while you're doing that, there's a lot to do on the business, right? So, and that's really the fun part. And the funny thing about fundraising is you spend so much time talking to these potential investors about all the amazing things that Wild Friends is going to do and all the great stuff that you're working on. And then yet you don't have as much time to do it because you're fundraising. And so it's really helpful having a co-founder for that reason, that I really spent most of my time focusing on the fundraise so that Erica was able to focus a lot of her time on the day-to-day execution of the business so that we didn't drop the ball even while fundraising.
Right. I was going to ask, how do you balance actually doing the work and then raising enough funds so that you can grow and do the work you want to do? So I guess that's an interesting takeaway. Just have a co-founder and you can divide the work.
Really. You know, and it's not necessarily that simple. I think some of it, too, is just being easier on yourself as a co-founder and recognizing that fundraising is work. You know, I think a lot of us think like, well, all I did today was have, you know, 8 calls with different investors. I didn't actually do anything, but those calls are doing something. That is work. So you get to, you know, you can give yourself a pat on the back for the work you're doing fundraising. That's your job. And once you recognize it as your job, it makes it a lot easier to delegate work to the other people that you're working with, whether that you have a co-founder or you have someone else on your team. Like, you're dividing and conquering. I think it's easy to only think of the work you're doing on the business as quote unquote real work, but fundraising is real work too. And you can definitely, treat it that way and delegate accordingly.
And did you two sort of come to the conclusion that you were better suited to go out and be the face of the company and she was the one doing the day-to-day, or how did that conversation go?
That's a funny choice of words. I think that in different, we do have very different strengths. Like, for example, the first day we ever made nut butter, the first thing Erica did was post the company on Facebook and tell everyone about it. And the first thing I did was like make a spreadsheet to figure out how much we needed to charge to not lose money. And so we very early on had a pretty clear perspective of what where we wanted to put our energy and where our natural strengths were. And so in some respects, I think I'm the face of the company when it comes to like investor relations and sort of big picture company moves, like recruiting new employees, thinking about the structure of the business. But Erica is the face of the company when it comes to our social media and it comes to PR and marketing. And so the way we've divided our responsibilities is really like internal, external. So Erica is very focused on the external part of the company, really any part that the consumer engages with. And then I'm pretty engaged on the internal, which includes investors. So I'm our CEO and she is our chief brand officer.
Okay, that makes sense. Can you tell us a bit about your marketing strategy? And I'm trying to think of, you know, the way I found you guys was through social media. Do you put most of your effort and budget into that? What are some other innovative ways that you've marketed the products?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, like any company with a small budget, anything grassroots is our best friend. So social is a huge thing we do. I think that's probably where we put the majority of our energy anyways. Most of our budget though does go into the in-store marketing, like the marketing that you might not think of as marketing as a consumer. So things like putting the product on sale, getting a display in a store, doing couponing, really investing in discovery. So how can the consumer find us for the first time? When you're a new brand, that's really what you're focused on. So what's going to drive trial? So it could be a demo. It could be a really great online discount to be able to try it, and then they'll pick it up next time they're in the store. It could be a display. It could be a really great price. Like, oh my gosh, that's such a good deal for nut butter. I'll try this brand because I've been wanting to try it for a while, but it seems too expensive to try for the first time. So that's where most of our budget goes into. If it's driving trial and it's getting people to test it out for the first time, it's probably a worthwhile investment for us.
Right. And do you guys find yourself still selling at farmers markets and those kinds of settings, or have you mostly transitioned into the online and store markets?
We mostly transitioned into stores and online. So we sell across the country in Target and Whole Foods, Wegmans, Publix, all sorts of chain sprouts, sorts of chains like that. So most national natural accounts we have some presence in, Kroger as well. And then we sell online on Amazon and on our own store. So it's really kind of split between those two things. And we do make appearances at events and farmers markets, but that's mostly a marketing experience for us versus the big part of our revenue at this point.
I'm wondering if you can tell us about the stockist strategy and what those conversations were with, you know, the retail people. And perhaps if you could touch on getting into Amazon, that would be really interesting.
Yeah, so I mean, the strategy has definitely evolved over the years. When we first started, it was all about just getting our product into stores, right? So the first thing we didn't know anybody, like we didn't know anything about retail. All we knew is we had a peanut butter that we thought was really good. So we would just walk into local grocery stores and, you know, find the buyer and say, hey, we have a nut butter we think that you're going to like and give it to them. And hopefully they put it on the shelf. And obviously, you know, as we've gotten bigger, we can't kind of play the, oh, we didn't know really how to do it card. So the way that process works is that we go to meetings. So a retailer will have a meeting with, say, 10 different nut butter suppliers. We go to a meeting, we tell them why they should carry our nut butter and why consumers like it and our sales story. And then they choose to bring it in or not, depending on their goals for their set.
Right. And what was the Amazon process like for your company?
Yeah. Amazon's really open to anyone. So anyone can sell anything they want. But because it's so complicated and there are a lot of ways to, it's always changing and evolving. And there are a lot of ways to make sure you're listed really well. There's also ways that you can accidentally mess up your listing or not be the first listing on the page. We've ended up working with a third party company that helps companies like ours list their products on Amazon and then manage them. So they're called Beekeeper Marketing and we've really enjoyed working with them. They've been really knowledgeable and have helped us get set up the right way because Amazon is a beast. It's a whole whole different way of doing business. And since we've been mostly focused on retail, we've not put as much of our team's energy into specifically managing that.
Right. That's interesting, just the way they're so open, but it also is just a different, a whole nother process.
It's very challenging. Yeah.
Yeah.
If anyone has Amazon experience, I always want to talk to them because it's a fascinating landscape. And it's the future of grocery too. So it's something we really care about and want to have a good presence on. But it is a whole different world.
Yeah, yeah. I'm wondering, you mentioned partners. What have been some key partnerships for your company in helping you guys grow?
Partnerships, I mean, we are very partnership-oriented. I mean, our whole brand is based on friendship, right? So Erica and I, like, we love relationships, we love partnerships, we love meeting new people and meeting new brands and collaborating with other co-founders. So you'll notice on our social, we do a lot of giveaways with other brands, and those are usually just brands that we're friends with, right, that we like, and we either want people to know, their fans to know about us, and they want our fans to know about them, and so it's a really great trade. And then we also love to collaborate with influencers. And so we've always, had fun relationships with some of the women and men on Instagram that are telling people, about different healthy foods and want to, give them different recipes. And so we have really strong partnerships with influencers as well. So we'll do things like share their products, share whatever they're up to on our Instagram, and then they help talk about our brand. And those are always best received when they're authentic. So we never send someone our product and they don't like it, and then we convince them to post about it, right? Like, we send them product, if they like it, they post about it, and that feels much more authentic to the consumer. I think consumers are really smart, and they can tell when something's just, hashtag sponsored, and never see that influencer eat that product again. And that we definitely always want to seem honest and open and transparent, because those are really big brand values of ours.
And I think that's really encouraging to hear as a consumer, and as the marketing landscape is changing and you don't exactly know what these influencers are and what is sponsored. And sometimes it's okay if you're sponsored if you really believe in the product. And so I think, that transparency and trust is just so important. And I see it within your activities on social media, at least. So.
Thank you. That's great to hear. Yeah. It's really important to us that the authenticity of our partnership feels real to the consumer, because otherwise it's just another ad, right?
Exactly. I'm wondering, so just in general, what lessons have you learned along the way? And so looking back and then looking forward, what other directions has running this company taken you in ways that you perhaps didn't expect when you were in your kitchen making with
so many things. I mean, I think that one of the things that always has frustrated me, I think, when I hear interviews with entrepreneurs, on whether it's on a podcast or read their book or whatever, is that I think it's really easy to leave out all the really hard stuff and just talk about the victories. Being an entrepreneur is really hard, and we left college 2 years in. Left our friends, left kind of the fun of college to focus on the business, and we've had each other, which has made it a lot easier. But there's definitely a ton of ups and downs. There's lots of times when you feel frustrated by the business not growing quickly enough, or a product not being received the way you want it to be, or even, like I alluded to earlier, you hire someone that doesn't work out. And so I think what I've learned is just that everybody, this is true across all careers, but including entrepreneurship, is like everybody's just doing their best, and everybody has their struggles and their low points, especially as I've gotten closer to other entrepreneurs. So I would just encourage people that want to start a business to make sure they have a good network and make sure they have a good support system of friends, because I've learned that that's so important for us as we continue this 7-year and beyond journey of running the company. It's not sustainable if you see it as like a sprint. Definitely an endurance event, and you have to have a really strong network to support you.
Yeah, and that's really important to hear as someone who is going through an entrepreneurship class right now, and and it's just 6 months. We need to, have a project for 6 months, and it's October, and we're already feeling, a little bit burnt out because we're so
obsessed
with the project. What are some ways that you sort of maintain your ability to have your company run as a marathon rather than a sprint?
I'd say the biggest thing is setting normal work hours. I mean, you can work every hour of the day and still have work to do. So, you know, it's not always possible. We definitely do a lot of travel, and that is kind of a, you know, when you're traveling, you're pretty much on the whole time, depending on what you're up to. But, you know, when you've been doing it for several years, you realize, like, me working 10-hour, 12-hour days, multiple days in a row, ends up ultimately being detracting from my long-term energy. It's always thinking about the long game. Like, what's the most sustainable system I can set up? And then I really would encourage people to think carefully about who they're going to need on their team in order to enjoy their life. Like, you have to enjoy what you're doing as you're an entrepreneur. But then, of course, there are little things like, you know, we exercise, we make an important priority to exercise, because for me, that's like my therapy. And therapy is important too. I've had a business coach. Erica and I have both gone to therapy over the course of the business for different things. Just really giving yourself like so much self-care, and then giving yourself pats on the back, because when you're running a company, or when you're in entrepreneurship class, like, nobody's there to say, like, you're doing a great job, like, keep up the good work, your own manager. So taking the opportunity whenever possible to step back and look and realize all the stuff you've accomplished. So even for you, like, what you've accomplished since the beginning of your class, and saying, wow, I've done a lot in a short period of time. So in giving yourself that pat on the back is good motivation to keep going.
Well, thank you. That is good to hear. and I'm actually glad that entrepreneurs are making that choice to have some work-life balance. And I'm sure that it trickles down onto your team. So that level, setting by example, the fact that life exists outside of your business, no matter how passionate you are about your mission and the product. So,
yeah, definitely.
So I guess to wrap up, my final question would be, really, what's next for your company? Where do you see your products and your brand, perhaps in 10 years, if you want to think that far ahead?
I mean, we are really passionate about some of our Give Back program that we're working on, and that's a program called 1% for Women and Girls, and that is a program that gives 1% of our revenue back to programs that benefit women and girls, whether that's scholarships or business grants or our partnership with Girls Inc., which is a national nonprofit. So personally, I'm very excited to continue to flesh that out even as the business grows. I think what we get most excited about is what a lot of entrepreneurs get excited about, which is solving problems. So continuing to solve problems in the food system and make food more delicious, more healthy, and more portable. So that's what we're doing across different products over the next 10 years. So I'm excited about that. And then also excited about solving potentially more existential problems around helping women find funding, empowering women to pursue their dreams, and to support girls, even if they don't have the same sort of access to resources and mentorship that Erica and I were lucky enough to have. So hopefully puts them in a better situation to pursue their dreams, like we've been very lucky to be able to do. So those two paths, basically, I feel the most excited about, the product side and then what the product can do to give back.
Follow Wild Friends on social media and visit wildfriendsfoods.com for more info and to see their full line of products. Join us for the next episode of the Impact Report on Friday, April 5th. For our complete lineup and other news, visit us at impactreportpodcast.com and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. BARD MBA in Sustainability is one of a select few graduate programs globally that fully integrates sustainability into a core business curriculum. Learn more at bard.edu/MBA.